Graham. This particular system is really old. No one's really sure exactly where it came from, but we're guessing it's over 3,000 years old, and it's only recently become taught in this kind of a format. It used to be taught on a one-to-one basis, and I'm going to tell you more about it, but first I have a question. How many people in this room have ever been lost?
Lost.
If you've ever been lost, in your car, on your bike, at Penny's, in the parking lot, you know, if you're at the village.
How long does it take?
Oh, lost?
2 minutes, 30 seconds, an hour and a half, what's lost?
Lost is lost.
Lost is half a second.
Now, depending on who you are, half a second can be a very, very long time. And for some of you, an hour may not be long enough. Being lost is one of the common denominators of being human, I think. I have a second question, since everybody here seems to have been lost at one time or another. What do you do when you get lost?
You go to where you know where you were.
Go to where you know where you were. Backtrack.
Run around
in circles.
What? Figure out where you are and figure out how to get where you're going.
Figure out where you are, but if you're lost, how do you know where you are?
Ask for help.
What else do you do?
Have the street sign.
Panic. Look at the street sign.
Get angry.
Ooh. How many keep going?
I do. I enjoy it.
Maybe you'll eventually find something you're wearing.
That's right. Oh, I'll find it around here somewhere. There was an episode of a TV program called Home Improvement. There was an episode of a TV show, and Tim Allen and his wife are driving along, and he's just going to keep going. He knows they're going to get there eventually, and she's saying, would you stop? Would you do something? We got to do something. Look at the map. They didn't know where they were lost in a snowstorm. Okay, you know what I do when I'm lost? I'll share this with you. I go to 7-Eleven. Because I figure they may not know much, but they know where they are. And if they can tell me where I am, and I have a map, and I know where I've been, where I started, and they tell me where I am, then I have a pretty good idea of where I'm headed. Now, that gives me several options. I can either decide, maybe that's where I still want to go, or maybe I'm headed in the wrong direction. But the important thing is to understand where you are. Now, most of us have a past. Some of us will talk about it, some of us won't. But most of us have something that we've done before. That's kind of where we've been. And what I'm going to try and help you learn today and throughout this week, if you want to continue coming to sessions, is to figure out where you are. Now, the first thing I'm going to talk about is what I consider the core of the Enneagram system. Basic definition, Enneagram is broken down into two words, Ennea meaning nine and gram meaning point. The idea in the system is that there are nine distinct personality styles. And one of these styles is going to be what you're going to call your home style. This will be what's referred to as your personality type. I hesitate to use the word type because a lot of people associate it with Myers-Briggs. That, oh, I'm going to fall into a box. I don't want to be categorized. If I do this, then people are, you know, I don't want to have this in my life. The idea with the Enneagram is that everybody here lives someplace. Spokane, Seattle, Milwaukee, Holden Village. But everybody lives someplace. And that where you live kind of determines how you view the rest of the world. For example, if I grow up in Seattle and I visit New York, then when I see Staten Island ferries, I'm going to compare them to the ferries I understand in Seattle. If I go to Milwaukee and I'm used to going to a church in Seattle, when I walk into the church, I might go, this reminds me a lot of what I did in Seattle. So with the Enneagram, when you find your home type, when you find your style, what you're really doing is acknowledging where you are. It's a way of saying, here's where I am, and you can't change where you're from. Everybody's born someplace. That's where you're from. You've got a family. That's where you're from. So the idea of changing your type doesn't really make a lot of sense, because to change type would mean you'd have to actually uproot and be born someplace else. So the Enneagram perspectives are a way of looking at the world. It's a lens that we use to basically deal with our world, to deal with each other, to have relationship, to experience knowledge, to experience love, to experience pain. It's how we go through our lives. One of the key concepts in the Enneagram is the idea of the map. It's called the centers. The centers are basically three interactive parts that each of us has. These interacting circles here, I have to draw it like this so you can see the circles, but the idea is that one of these circles, one of these centers, is going to be dominant in you. You're either going to have a gut center, dominant, or a head center, or a heart center. I'm going to go into these in more detail in just a few minutes, but I want to show you something to help you understand what it means to have a center. And I have a handout to give toward the end of this, so if you're worried about taking a lot of notes and getting it all down, stop worrying. Let's see. That didn't work. And I brought these friends with me today to kind of exemplify what's going on. Typify the different centers, and by the end of this little discussion today, I think you'll be able to identify the centers that I'm talking about. First, I want to talk about something we all know and love and probably don't respect very much, but motivation. In a nutshell, we are motivated toward things that give us pleasure and away from things that cause us pain. When you're dealing with personality, things that give you pleasure usually can be two different kinds of things. A pleasurable experience is something you usually want to repeat, and a painful experience is usually something you want to avoid. When you're dealing with personality, painful things that happen in our lives, they're going to happen over and over again. Things happen to us with people. But we develop automatic reactions to dealing with these painful events. We move toward pleasure, that's what we want, but we're sort of, the stick is the pain, and we want to move away from it. What happens sometimes is that the dominant center that each of us has overcompensates. You'll get a center, say a gut center, and that gut center will become big, and we'll think we're more powerful than we really are. We'll tend to want to act straight out and take care of things. What I'm going to talk to you about right now are the different centers. And I've put colors to them, but it's only to exemplify. The gut people aren't really yellow. It's just that the color. You're only limited to so many colors and transparency. Okay. I'll be handing out a handout that has this information on it, so don't worry about writing it all down. But the gut center, each of us has one. And I've got a book in the bookstore if you want to read more about the different centers. It's very good. It's by Dan Millman called No Ordinary Moments. And it talks about the different interaction between the centers. But what I want to do here is explain to you what the centers really are. The gut center, which is the first circle, is how we feel about ourselves. Its focus is surviving, and it deals in present time. So if there's an actual threat or perceived threat, the gut center is saying, okay, I'm going to take care of this right now. I'm hungry, let's eat. I'm thirsty, I want to drink. I'm tired, I want to sleep. The gut center is very immediate. Its purpose is to provide safety. Keep you safe at all costs. Control is very important, controlling the environment, temperature, humidity, whatever. And the activities regard the flight or fight response, physical expression. When the gut is doing something, it's making it actual in the world. Voice quality, whether your voice is sounding very nervous, all of the things that your body does to express you is basically provided by the gut center. It's the end result. It's what everyone else sees. And what happens is our behaviors are all that really other people know us by. How you behave, how you act toward others, sort of determines how they see you. Now, you may have all the best intentions in the world, but what actually happens is how other people are going to perceive you. Physical coordination. The gut center is in charge of what I call grace, athletic movement, figure skating, skiing, anything that involves physical coordination and body memory. Because your ingrained habits, the way we walk, the way we speak, the things we like to eat. These kinds of things are what the body says, yeah, I like that chocolate, that's a good idea. Eye contact. Anytime you're making communication with people, if you're not looking into their eyes, somehow they may not be as interested because that connection is being made. The gut center reacts, that's very important to remember, reacts to a perceived threat. Now, whether it's an actual threat or not, and this can be related to phobias, and anxiety attacks, and internalized threat. Someone who thinks there's going to be a threat, that may not be a real threat, but that, to them it's real, so their gut is going to react to that. Time sense is concerned with what's happening out here. Real time is what I call it. The daily events. Sleep time, eat time. If the car in front of me slams its brakes on, that's real time, I gotta hit my brakes. And it's gotta be so automatic, I don't have time to think, geez, I wonder if I should hit my brakes now. A lot of what we do in driving is a good example, is how we kind of automatically go through physical reaction coordination. And the communication style for the gut center, for people who have it more than others, is just do it. Just take this and do it. I don't have time to think about it. I don't know how I feel about it. Just do it. Let's get it done. Now that can be themselves getting it done, or it can be them telling you to get it done. Impatience can be a hallmark of the gut center. Also, doing it at their own speed and at their own time can be a hallmark. Move on to the next one. I think we all have one of these. Some of us, anyway. The head center. This doesn't have anything to do with the Navy. But for some people, we may think it does. The head center deals with conscious thinking. And unfortunately, the head doesn't deal in the present. It deals in the past with what's gone by, reflection, or what might be coming up in the future, anticipation. The head kind of turns things over to the gut as they happen. Okay, go take care of this. And the gut gets it done. Focus for the tent is on, for the head center is on content, credibility, believability. Is this real? Is this not real? Discernment. The head is constantly thinking and comparing. It's a big activity for the head center. The purpose of the head center is to guide, to educate, and to reassure. How we think of ourselves is primarily a product of what the head center tells us. Now, people who prefer the head center, you'll find them being very analytical, observant, things in, comparing, categorizing, very good with facts and figures. And these people tend to want to explain a great deal because they have a great deal to explain. Vocabulary is important. Creating images. How we speak. What we say. The head's saying, okay, I prepare this presentation. Now what exactly do I need to put together to make this work? Outlining, planning, organizing. These are some of the tasks that the head center takes over for us. Time sense, like I said, is past and future. The head's not really sure what's happening in the moment, because by the time the information gets in, it's already passed. Communication style is what if. That can be possibility. Well, what if we tried this? How do you think this would work? What if we did this? What if we did that? And on the flip side of that is, what if this happens? What if I'm on the road to Chelan and I get a flat tire? And the worry and the anxiety. Because the head center creates fantasy based on what it's known before. And if there's a fear of being stranded or being isolated, then this is the kind of thing that the head will generate. And when you get the knot in your stomach, before you get up and speak in front of a crowd, or before you have to do something important, whether it's taking an exam or going to the doctor, the head's going, what if something's wrong? What if I fail? What if my fly is down? So the head's always kind of looking out for us, and it's sort of like long-range sensors. I'm kind of aware of what's going on in the environment, and it's coming in, but it only comes in through my eyes and my ears. Mostly for the head, that's how it operates, what it hears and what it sees. Any questions on the head center before I move on? We'll get back to the movie soon, just be patient. The next center, as you might guess, is the red heart center. That's a good red, too. The heart center is a little difficult to explain because it's more concerned with how you feel. Now, some people confuse feeling with thinking. If you ask somebody what they feel, they might say, I think that da-da-da-da-da-da. And what you're really asking for is a feeling, not an explanation. I feel sad, or I feel happy. I'm feeling nervous. I'm feeling excited. The focus on the heart center is to relate. I want to know how I'm doing. The head center pretty much chooses the course. The gut center says, fine, let's go this way. And the heart center says, are we on course? Are we off course? Do we need to adjust? It's that slight little twist of your hand on the steering wheel that you don't notice while you're driving down a familiar road that keeps you from running over that pothole you get every day. The need for the heart center is approval. I want you to like me. I want to be liked, and I want to like you. Because if I like you, then I'm on course. That what I'm saying is not only registering, but it means something to you. The purpose, like I say, is to establish an emotional link. Now, I've used this for explaining public speaking to people, because it's important to understand what your dominant center is in order to become more familiar with how you deal with information, how you deal with other people, and generally how you deal with your expectations of how you expect the world to be. Our feelings provide us feedback. You can think of it like hot and cold. You ever play that game when you were a kid? You know, you're getting colder, you're getting hotter, and you keep making variations in your ideas until finally you're on target and you say, yes, that's it. Oh, hot, 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 cold, cold, cold. Well, our feelings are doing that all the time. It's our feelings that tell us, I think it could rain. You know, I'm feeling like you feel it. First you feel it, and then you tell the heart tells the brain, you might want to put on a jacket, I think it's going to rain. And the head says, oh, rain. Well, the clouds look like, and it starts analyzing, but the initial idea from the heart center. The heart center is what allows us to be inspired and allows us to inspire others. We create an emotional connection. And the time sense for the heart center is present time internal. The heart center is an internal time situation. A situation that happened to you when you were a child, perhaps, might trigger a memory that when you start to do something that you haven't done in 20 years but you're suddenly afraid to do it, that's the heart center reminding you, this didn't feel right last time, I don't know if I want to do this again. The gut center is just saying, fine, let's not do it again. So the reaction time is very quick. The heart says, no, I don't think we should do this, and the gut says, well. And the head says, well, now, really? I mean, I'm an adult now, I'm not afraid of spiders anymore. But whenever I see one in the bathtub, like this morning, I don't want him in there. Well, when I was five, they looked like they were, you know, pretty big, but now they're a little smaller. Communication style is, how am I in relationship to you? Relationship to God, in relationship to the world. How am I doing? Am I on course? Is my life on course? Am I lost? The heart center is usually the one that says, I haven't seen anything familiar for a little while, maybe we should stop and check. And it tells the head, sure, we need a Coke, let's go and have a 7-Eleven. And the gut says, yeah. Okay. So, are there any questions about the centers right now? I don't want to confuse you. This is the core element of the Enneagram system. Because what happens is, you get these centers in combination, and that starts to determine your personality style that you prefer. So you might have somebody who's very gut oriented, but their second center is their head center. So they tend to act and then think, and they'll feel about it later. Right.
Where the heart is more people-oriented.
The heart is more is concerned with its image. Mm-hmm. How do I feel about myself?
How you work together instead of if we get tasks done or not, but more about how we're doing to do the process.
Right. But you might have somebody who's very heart-oriented and then very head-oriented. So they have a lot of feelings, but then they stop and think about their feelings. And sometimes they think that's enough, so they don't express the feelings. So they expect you to feel what they're feeling, but they haven't given you an indication of their feeling. It hasn't come out through their gut, so they're most removed from the gut center. And each one of the types is a combination of these three centers. Okay, so when we start talking about type in a few minutes, you'll understand more. But first, back to our regularly scheduled program. I want you to try and tell me which character is which center.
Some people without brains do an awful lot of talking.
I guess you're right.
Okay, that's number one. Which center do you think?
My goodness, I can talk again. Oh, all my hands, please. All my elbows.
About a year ago, I was chopping that tree when suddenly it began to rain. And right in the middle of the chop, I rusted solid. Been that way ever since.
Well, you're perfect now.
Perfect? Bang on my chest if you think I'm perfect. Go ahead, bang on it. Beautiful. One nickel. The tinsmith forgot to give me a heart.
No heart?
No heart.
What do you think? Does he have a heart?
Yeah.
I think you're right. Well, these two leave one. I think you can guess which one is which. The scarecrow, to me, represents the head center. It says he doesn't have a brain. But in the entire story, all he's doing is thinking. And sometimes he's thinking and he doesn't know what to do with his thinking. It's just like all the time. Well, I don't know which way to go, maybe this way, maybe that way. Okay. The thing that he wants the most is to have a brain, but the things he does most is use his head. And Dorothy, just so you know, Dorothy is, if the story is about her, and the different characters are the different parts of her. Okay, so I'm not trying to type Dorothy and put her into her perspective. I'm using the other characters to represent the different centers, because they are the pieces of her that she's got to integrate to be more whole. Tin Man feels so much better. He's worried because he doesn't have a heart. And in the whole movie, he seems to be caring the most. He has the depth of feeling. He has the feedback. He lets them know what's going on. Now, in the first scene, where they were all running across the field of poppies and panicking, oh my God, it's a problem. The first thing that happens is they're all together, and they're linked arm in arm as they get to this field. And then, what do? They separate, and they run as individuals. And as soon as they separate, calamity happens, and the witch's spell takes over. Well, the scarecrow doesn't know what to do. But he's the only one that's not affected by what's happening around him. The heart center freezes. And we're going to look at the gut center in a minute, because it's important. That's why I'm saving it. But don't worry. And the head center's like, help, help, screaming, and doesn't know, should he pick up Dorothy, should he move on? He becomes lost in his center. He doesn't know which is the best thought. Suddenly he's lost the ability to really focus and keep things together. All right, let's look at the last one. And no, it's not the witch. Okay.
This one you fight. I fight you about the get of your war. I fight you one poor time behind a man.
I'd like to stand on one foot. I'd like to put my eyes closed. Oh, pulling an axe on me, eh? Sneaking up on me, eh?
Why? Here, go away and let us alone.
Oh, scared, huh? Afraid, huh? I don't care to stay fishing, I can.
Come on, get up and fight, you shivering junkyard. Put your hands up, you lopsided bag of hay.
Now, that's getting personal, Lion.
Yes, get up and teach him a lesson.
Well, what's wrong with you teaching him?
Well, I hardly know him.
I'll get you in a happy wheel.
Okay. The gut center sometimes doesn't think very much. Not concerned with how you're feeling very much. The gut center, in a lot of ways, is like a little child. I'm just going to take care of me. I'm the king of the forest. I'm in charge. The gut center is interested in being powerful. It's what it does is survival. And then we find out, after a little slap on the nose, he's just a big baby. He thinks he's a coward. He doesn't have courage. Well, and the gut center is concerned with its place in the world. It wants to exist because survival is the key element for what it's trying to do. Now, it can survive by being powerful. It can survive by being in charge. It doesn't necessarily mean you're powerful, but if you can have control, you can have control over the powerful people as long as you've got the control. Or it can just be. It can be like a rock in the road. It can prevent you from moving forward because it's lazy sometimes. It's like the lion. Oh, 40 winks doesn't sound half bad. Thump! And there it sits. And what do? You can't lift it. You can't move it. You've just got to be with it. So these three different centers, as long as they act as individuals, have a really hard time. And the task in the movie, of course, Dorothy is kidnapped by the witch and they've got to go save her. They can't do it as individuals. They have to pull together. Dorothy's internal system has to somehow save her from the Wicked Witch. And we find by the end of the movie that she could go home all the time. All she had to do is clap her feet, her heels together with some ruby slippers and she'd be fine. Well, these centers are in each of you. And what I want you to think about for today, while you're wandering the woods and things, is go back over your past and try to identify which one of these centers seems to be most dominant for you. Because what I'm going to tell you now, and we'll kind of look at this. Let's see. Oops. Where did it go? I'm missing an overhead. Oh, that was bad. Okay. Basically, there are three types, or three centers, and nine types. And I don't have that overhead with me.
Now we watch and see how you react.
Yeah, that's right. I try to be very calm and going, oh my God, my fly's down. Yeah. Okay. Help me, Spock. Crisis management. I had this all organized, and then I had to go on Garbology this morning.
Oh.
So if it stinks in here a little, it's me. Anyway, well, shades of lightning, folks, it's not here. It's okay. We have in the Enneagram system, and I will put this up because I want you to...
There's a blackboard behind that thing.
There's what?
Blackboard behind that.
There's a map on the blackboard. This doesn't go up very well. I fought with that earlier. Anyway, I'll just put this back up and we'll use it. Thank you. Okay. So you see the interaction of the centers with this crack in the middle. Kind of neat. What happens is that one of the centers will usually, under a stressful situation, over-control. The gut center may expand, okay? So if you try to imagine one circle stacked on top of another, okay, they're interacting all the time. That's why I show the interaction. But if the gut center is really big, and then the head center is the secondary center, then maybe that heart center is the least developed. So when the gut over-dominates, it really pushes that heart center down, if your secondary center is your head. And it works the way for the other centers. If you're primarily a heart-centered person, primarily feeling and caring and relating to others, then in times of stress, you might find yourself over-relating, taking care of other people's needs without asking them, and just going in and helping them. Or really feeling this depth of passion and emotion, but being even less able to express it. And for head-centered people, does anybody overanalyze? Do you get to the point where you've overthought the possibility? You've gone, I don't know what to think anymore because there's too many things to think about. So you start to feel something about what you know, and maybe you don't want to tell people what you know because you're afraid you don't know enough. Maybe they're going to ask you a question that you don't understand. So what I'm going to tell you now, and I'm going to show you the symbol, and some of you may have seen this before. This is what the Enneagram looks like. Okay? And then if I can do this and throw the centers on top of it. How's that? Yes. Actually, I'm going to hand you out some center stuff today. The rest you have to come back for, isn't that neat? Basically, we end up with these 9 different personality perspectives. The centers, and this is kind of a complicated diagram because of this, but I wanted you to see how the different centers interrelate. Up here you've got primarily guts on the 8, the 9, and the 1, or the champion, the negotiator, and the inspector. These are people that are primarily gut-oriented people. The gut tends to take charge. Over here you have the 5, 6, and 7 are primarily head-oriented people. I'm going to go into more depth about these later in the week because I don't want to run short of time here. Yeah, I'll explain this in just a second. You've got the sage, the facilitator, and the optimist are primarily head-centered people, and the assistant, the administrator, and the author are primarily heart-centered people. Now, sometimes the way I explain it is that you're really on a continuum. If you say, well, I think I'm a champion, that means you're somewhere between a bully and an altruistic, power-giving person. You're somewhere in between, and you can move in that continuum based on how much stress you're experiencing, based on your relationships, based on how you feel about yourself. Self-esteem is the key issue. And what I'm trying to do today is to give you an idea that will act like an alarm clock and sort of trigger a greater awareness than you normally have. Okay. So in the Enneagram itself, and the symbol, a lot of people associate the symbol with some sort of like pentagrams or satanic thing. Really, I've had people say, this is the devil's work, and I'm thinking, I don't think so. Because the lines themselves don't, you're not creating a star. Each point has 2 lines that connect to it. And by the end of this, not today, but by the end of this week, I'll be able to explain the lines to you a little bit more. Because they have to do with how your self-esteem is and how you tend to take on characteristics of another type, but your particular type already remains the same. So I'll start up here and go around the circle. I think we've got enough time. The champion, the 8, is like the knight in shining armor. Okay? The people in the village are kind of scared of him. He's kind of got all his equipment and his sword and his lantern and all this stuff. So they leave him alone because he's kind of bigger than life. And yet, when the dragon needs to be slain, when there's a threat to the village, the champion reluctantly goes out because the village says, we really need you to save us. We need you to do this. We need you to be powerful. And the champion goes out and says, okay. He slays the dragon. Goes out, does his thing, comes back, and what happens? The people are even more afraid of him because now is he not only a knight, he's a dragon slayer. And this becomes a real problem for some people because it's almost by looking at you he has more power. This particular perspective, some people have a lot of trouble with, people who are champions, because they seem abrasive. They seem like they're always in your face. Okay. The 8's phrase of recognition is, I am powerful. That's how they define themselves, inside. So that need to be in front of you, that need to be in charge. They're not so much concerned with keeping control as long as they are the ones that get the respect. You know that they're the ones that have the power. A good example of a champion, Katharine Hepburn in The African Queen, if you've seen that movie.
Clint Eastwood.
And almost any of his movies. Norman Schwarzkopf. Yeah. Well, just go over and we'll take care of it. And that's the way eights function. It's like, my name is Jip and I'm going to stand on this tank and I'm going to tell you what I can tell you. Boris Yeltsin seemed to have a lot of equality. I mean, just the idea of, well, I need to stand up in front of these people, and there's a tank here, so I'm going to stand on this tank, and I'm going to let these people know who has the power. It was a very trying time in 1991 when Soviet Union started to come apart. Clint Eastwood, when he's facing the guy on the street, he says,
well, do you feel lucky, punk? Do you?
You realize that the gun's already empty. We know this. And we realize that the power isn't in the gun, it's in him. He could be pointing his finger at this crook and the guy would still be shaking. The power for the ape is inside. It's an inner power. It's not something they garnish from out here. They're not being told they're powerful. They just know it. That's their strength. And they're very good leaders because they tend to go where they think they should have to go, and people follow them fairly readily. Jesus would, well, I think the scene in the temple where he basically said, get out of here. This is not a place for money changers and self-generics. This is a place of worship. And he lost his temper, and he went in there and did this, and it was kind of against the rules. But he also had that way of healing people on Sunday. Shouldn't be doing that. But he did it anyway because he knew what he had to be doing. And so there's a strength of purpose. Now, in the person of Jesus Christ, there's every time is there. He's completely integrated. The idea is that most of us live toward the edge of this circle. We become more involved in our type, and especially under stress, we take on very specific characteristics because we drift from our centeredness. Now, this isn't so much being self-centered as it is being holistic and being completely centered, so that you can use positive characteristics of all of the types most effectively. Jesus did this. He was the example of it. Don't be too concerned about things not going your way. Love each other. I'm going to teach you these things, but I'm going to need you to follow me and do this. The negotiator 9 is the peacemaker. Favorite thing to say is, it's okay. It's okay. Don't worry about it. It's okay. They like to smooth out the wrinkles in the bed. They like to make it nice and easy. They don't like waves. They don't like conflict. But they tend to be very warm. Yeah?
Sure. Yeah, that's what I think that when men take the square where your hubris is on the edge of here, this is coming down the road here, where this is on the arc.
What's that?
A man's square of about personality has to have doers, have analytical.
Oh, I know what you're talking about.
And this makes sense when you start talking about this, mm-hmm. where the champion's up here, the negotiator is down here.
Right, well, the champion is here, and the
right.
negotiator is at the top. Well, and the thing is that the negotiator is in the center of the gun. So the negotiator is really concerned. The 9 is really concerned with comfort and everybody being comfortable. I want things to be nice and comfortable and warm and happy for everybody. A good example of a 9, Gerald Ford. The country is in disarray after Watergate, right? And Gerald Ford comes up and says, I know how to fix this. I'll just pardon Nixon and we'll get on with life. In fact, I'm going to pardon a bunch of people because I don't need this hassle. And one of the most amazing things that he did was when he was walking off the airplane, or you all remember this, or some people, and he's walking along and he tripped. And in that moment in time, it was like all of the United States was resting on his shoulders. And this whole thing with Watergate and the exposure and the press and everything, and he fell, and then he just got up, brushed himself up, and just kept on going. It wasn't a big scene. People didn't rush up to try to help him. And it was like a big sigh of relief because that's the turning point. That was the turning point after Watergate when our country started to come back together. Oh, I think of another good example of a 9. Jimmy Stewart in It's a Wonderful Life. Oh, okay, fair enough. Take care of it. Now he gets real worried that, you know, suddenly he's lost his $5,000 and they're going to come apart at the scene. But through the whole story, he's real busy just keeping things okay. It's real important for him that everything goes just right. Not trying to make it go perfectly, he's just trying to keep it from getting any worse. He doesn't like the conflict. And his temper comes out, but not as often. Yeah? All right, the Inspector 1. The Inspector 1 is the next person in the gut center. The Inspector 1 is one of the most discerning of all the types. They tend to see things very clearly, right and wrong. Black and white. They're very good at seeing what needs to be done what should be done and what has to be done. And they're very good at telling you that has to happen. Now, they think that what they're doing is helpful, that this is, of course, well, of course you want it to be better. Of course the lawn should be mowed. Of course we should organize. They tend to be very structured people, and their structures work. There's a negative side in that they can become over rigid and inflexible because they have an ideal of how things ought to be, but because we live in an imperfect world, it sort of gets their gall. And they get very upset with the fact that, why can't it be this way? And so sometimes ones will take on a cause. Ralph Nader is a good example of one. You know, consumer advocate, look, you gotta make products that work. You can't make toys that are gonna choke children. And so he becomes, in some ways, like a champion, but what he's really concerned with is that things should be better. And the champion's more concerned with, am I in charge? You know, in the scene in Dirty Harry, where Clint Eastwood's in his coffee shop, the crime is going on out in the street. He could care less. But as soon as the moron comes into his coffee shop, he says, oh, and so he had to come and why this coffee shop? But then he gets up and takes care of it. So the difference really between an ape and a one, or the inspector and the champion, is the difference between somebody who wants to control what's happening out here and somebody who's mostly concerned about controlling what's happening here. The ape is concerned mostly with their own space. And the one is sometimes concerned with your space. Not because they're interested in controlling you, but because they share that space, and boy, if I'm going to be in this space, it's going to be the way I want it to be. So, excuse me for telling you to tie your shoe, but tie your shoe. It would be nicer. It would be nice if the lawn were edged. It would be nice if the car were clean. And sometimes it can become almost too much, and the one doesn't have as much control of the situation as they want. So they try to impose order, where instead of just saying, oh, okay, it's good enough. Ones can tend to work very long hours. They like to work. They think working hard is the way to succeed. And they can define themselves in the way their self-identity is, I'm hardworking. Look how hard I'm working. Don't you see how hard I'm working? I'm working hard to make this a better world. I'm working hard to make this a better office. Working hard to make this a better family. Can't you understand? And they can get angry because their intensity is so much that people go, now, ones you think nines and ones wouldn't get along. But they do, because the ones rail at the nines, and the nines go, okay. So there's cooperation between the types, but where you find yourself is going to be like, oh, God, I don't want to be that type. I don't like that part of myself. The idea is that the gut center in all three of these types is overacting, over-dominant. When a person in the one orientation says, do this, they're not really concerned, they're not thinking ahead to how you might feel about it, because what's important to them is establishing the order and structure. They want that to be better. They want it to be improved. New and improved. I think that was invented by a one. Yeah. What was wrong with old and okay? I don't need brighter orange cheese on that Kraft macaroni. Okay. You first.
I read an article that Clinton was a nine.
Well, one of the dangers, one thing I don't do, and so don't ask me, is I won't tell you what type you are. And it's okay to possibly, I use characters for movies because, number one, they're not real, and they tend to overemphasize certain aspects.
Public people aren't real.
Well, public people are. They're a product of the media.
Our president.
Our president. Well, we'll talk about him in a little while. I don't think he's a nine.
You don't think he is?
I think there's a big difference between Bill Clinton and Gerald Ford. Well, we'll talk about freedom in a minute. We're going to move on to the heart center. Remember, the heart center is concerned with, how are you doing? How are you feeling? Is everybody doing okay? What do you need? Can I help you? Can I help me? Can you help me? Help! And that takes us to the assistant two. And the two defines themselves as being helpful. They are very good at perceiving everyone else's needs but their own. These people are the most wonderful people. They make you feel very welcome. They're welcoming people, warm-hearted, and because of the orientation of the centers, they tend to feel what's necessary, and then they act. They think, this is what you need. Let me get it for you. Now, they have a thought do you need this or not? Because it's a perceived need, and they really want to make you comfortable. My grandmother is a student, or I'm an assistant, and one of her favorite phrases is, "May it be good for your health." Even if she's giving you a deck of cards, she's always concerned with how you're feeling. And I remember more times than not growing up that dinner on the table would be cold for her by the time she sat down after pouring all the milk and getting all the salad dressing and get everything out. She wanted to make sure everybody else was taken care of, and then she would sit down and eat herself. Now, this isn't a bad thing, but it's, again, it's a behavioral response to a perceived need for other people. The assistants are least aware of what they need themselves. So they've defined themselves by being good people, by being able to take care of you, to take care of me. And it's very difficult for them to take care of themselves because probably from a very early age, they've either been forced or expected to take care of others. So it's much easier for them to say to you, if, say for example, your assistant has wrecked the car. And you go out and you see the car and they say, "Well, I'm really sorry I wrecked the car. What can I do for you? How can I make it up to you? I'm groveling. Please, let me do something for you so I feel better." Right. Instead of just saying, I need you to forgive me for wrecking the car. It's a very different conversation. So then the assistant is asking for something that they need rather than for something that you need. A good example of an assistant is Mother Teresa. Going off to India to help the poor, she's not so much thinking of herself, but in a way she is, because that's how she's defined herself. It's helping others. So I'm going to go help people that really need help, where I can make a difference. A good example of a male, too, would be Father Mulcahy from Nash. Very concerned with how you're doing, and very troubled in his own life because he's trying to figure out what he needs. How can he best serve this medical unit out in the middle of Korea? The administrator 3, very recognizable people. They are goal-driven people for the most part. And they define themselves by being successful. So much so that they identify with the success or the failure of what they're working on. So if the project fails, then they're failures. And if the project succeeds, then they're heroes. 3s are so good at getting things done that they can convince you that what they're doing is not only honorable or reasonable or helpful, or whatever you need to hear so that they can get your help. 3s are, they're very good salesmen. They tend to be very good, and it's funny because you think, well, this is more of a head person. He's trying to figure out what's going on, and then he's acting to make it happen. But what's happening is they're feeling, they're using their heart center to figure out where you are. They want to connect to you because by helping you, then they're a success. If I can sell you a car, if you come to me looking for a car, and I say, "Well, what kind of car do you want?" And you say, "Well, I want that little blue thing over there." I say, "Well, you know, that's a really nice car, but inside of me, I get more commission if I sell this car." I say, "Have you thought about this red car over here? Now, let me tell you a little bit about it before you make up your mind." And so they're very good at telling you things that you will hear to go along with them. They will change the goal so that your goal is suddenly the same as theirs. A good example of a 3, did you ever see Top Gun?
Yeah.
All right. Tom Cruise in Top Gun, he plays this naval aviator. He is so concerned with being the best, and that's one word that 3s like to use. I am the best at what I do. I want to be the best. I have the best car. I'm competitive and I succeed, so I'm good. But you'll find that they don't set their goals much higher than they can achieve. They want to be sure they're going to win. It's because really they're afraid of losing, that if they fail, they're going to fall right into a hole. So better to set the goal not too high, like the ones. Ones set goals that are clear up to the stars, and they expect to reach them, so they have a lot of intensity and a lot of energy, and they want to do that. But the administrator 3 says, "I'm going to go to the next stoplight. My goal is to get to the next stoplight, so I've got to get through this one." And then they go in measured increments, and they have little benchmarks along the way to know how they're doing. Are they on course? What's happening? I think Bill Clinton falls into the administrator category more than the negotiator category. Primarily from the way that he ran the race for president. He convinced everybody he should be president. He told people what they wanted to hear so he could get into the office. And it wasn't, he wasn't trying to fool everyone. It was just that his goal was very apparent to me. At least watching the elections and watching what he did. I mean, the title of being Slick Willie and having all of this kind of baggage following him around lent him to being very much in that free role, much like Tom Cruise, who was a little bit more of a maverick, if you will, wild flying pilot. I'm going to try to move quickly, we're running out of time. The third type in the Heart Center is the author, the four. These people define themselves as being unique or unordinary. They need to feel like they're different. If you see a group of kids on the corner with all their hair punked out and the leather jackets and all this stuff on, the one person in the group who's probably the four is the one that's dressed like a preppy. Or the one that doesn't have the hair pumped that looks more like a regular person because they have to stand out. So how can you stand out in a group that's standing out if you look like this? I think Marilyn Monroe was a four. They're very emotional people. They feel things very deeply, but they have a very hard time expressing them. In the movie Dead Poets Society, if you saw that movie at all, I'm referring to movies because I watch them and basically put things on the video. The young actor, the boy who wants to be the actor, who wants to be in Shakespeare, wants to run on the press, wants to do all these things, and he's got this father that says, you are going to be this way. Your mother and I have put so much into you, you can't disappoint us. I'll tell you what type he is. I think you can guess. But the boy has all of this symbolism that he uses to explain himself. This Dead Poet Society, going into this cave, starting this very unique group, because he's afraid of falling into being the banker or the doctor or anything that's usual. Fours will go out of their way, the authors will go out of their way to experience life differently, and they think they do. They're convinced that they're different from everybody else. So the hardest thing for them feeling like they fit in because they don't want to. And as soon as they feel like they're fitting in, they get anxious. Because, oh my God, I've got to do something different. I've got to present backwards. I've got to do something else. Julia Roberts in Pretty Woman, I think so. I think Meryl Streep plays a lot of roles that are very four-oriented, where there's a lot of emotion on the face and there's a lot of feeling, but there's so little expression. It's like the four really expects you to understand what they're feeling when they give you something that's this big and they put all of this feeling into it and they give it to you and you go, gee, that's really nice, and you set it aside and the whole world collapses. Nobody understands. Nobody wants to understand. They walk off and they look like they're sulking, but actually they're reveling in this experience because the emotions have to be very intense in a way. Nobody loves me, isn't that great? But the thing is, fours are very artistic people. And of all of the types, they think they're the most emotionally sensitive.
I think I have to leave now.
But the thing about them is, you're attracted to them, and especially the assistant, too. See the fours and say, God, I can really help this person. And there's a danger involved in that the fours are so... Their stress is to be drawn into relationships so they can be defined, because they have a difficult time defining themselves. They make excellent actors and actresses because they're very good at taking a role and imagining how that character would feel. So they say, oh, I can do that. And so they jump into this role. And I think Dustin Hoffman plays a very good, and he may be a four, I don't know the man personally, but the roles that he has done, especially Cassell Hook, when he played Captain Hook in the movie, It's like he disappears into these roles. I forget, when I was watching Tootsie, I forget it was Dustin Hoffman. I mean, there's an extraordinary way of acting. So there are different, and I'll use different examples of the fours as we go along. I'm gonna have here, okay, the five. The sage five might be what you expect. Fives are very analytical, very information driven. They like a lot of ideas, but they're very good researchers. They tend to be, they're so observant, they suck everything up. New information? New bookstore in town? Let's go! Get it! I'm on my way. They have such a compendium of knowledge, but they have this little tiny restriction of an outlet to give it to you. Imagine going into the Library of Congress, and you have to slip in the door like this,
because the valve is shut down so tight.
They have a lot of information,
and they know where it all is.
And they define themselves as I am knowing. And that's what's important to them, is knowing. Not telling you about it. They just want to know it, because then they feel more safe. Like there's this, there's always the possibility somebody's going to ask a question. I can't answer. And I think a five invented the phrase, it's better to keep your mouth shut and let everybody think you're a fool than to open it and let everybody know you're a fool. Move on down. There's a lot of examples of fives, especially in the teaching environment, professors that get all this knowledge. I am a chemistry professor, and I'm going to explain to you the laws of this chemical reaction with this and that and the other thing. They go on for 25 or 30 minutes, and at the end of that, they do this, and they say, there aren't any questions, are there? What they're really saying is, God, don't ask me a question. So they phrase it, there aren't any questions, are there? You know, sometimes it's just a statement, it's not even a question. They sometimes will look like they're looking right through you. But what they're really doing is sucking up all the information about how you dress, how your hair is, all this memory, all this stuff going on. An important story about a five is that they tend to read very carefully.
Tend to what?
Read books carefully. And I'll explain that. When a five, and some of you may know the Sage Five people in your life, when they read, it's sort of like working on a computer and opening up Windows files. Opening up Windows files. They have a lot of different...